Hi, everyone, and welcome to a very special edition of Franchise Interviews, where for over 5 years, we've been asking the franchisepreneurs to own one. I'm your host, Marty McDermott, and I'm the president of Franchise Interviews, and we have a great show this morning. We're meeting with the popular Dr. Scott Shane to discuss born entrepreneurs, born leaders, and the illusion of entrepreneurship. Born Entrepreneurs, Born Leaders is the first book to review the entire range of scientific literature on genetic effects on organizational behavior and explain in practitioner-friendly manner how your DNA affects your workplace behavior. The Illusions of Entrepreneurship challenges the myths we hold about entrepreneurs in America, and that's coming right up on Franchise Interviews. So stick around because we got a great show.
Are you one of those special people who are willing to go after your dreams and goals? Are you ready to fulfill that dream of owning your own business with the security of a proven brand, the opportunity to take control of your future and own a Rita's Italian Ice franchise is within your reach?
Rita's is seeking success-oriented individuals who are ready to make a change in their life, and Rita's offers unparalleled training and support to assure your success. And did you know the frozen treat industry is a recession-proof industry, and there are Rita's in 23 states currently with 540 stores open. Rita's Italian Ice has been around for 25 years and is listed as a top-performing franchise by the Wall Street Journal.
Now here's the really good part. Rita's Italian Ice is a unique and amazing taste treat. It's smoother than a snow cone, and it combines ice with real fresh fruit. The real fruit adds dramatically to the taste, and it comes in over 40 flavors. The ice and fruit are mixed on site and made fresh daily, and it is delicious.
You'll want to know more about this exciting and successful franchise opportunity. Go to www.ownaritas.com and get all your questions answered. That's www.ownaritas.com to take control of your dreams and future today. You don't want to wait any longer to be a part of this adventure. www.ownaritas.com.
Franchisers, are you looking to reach aspiring entrepreneurs looking to buy a franchise? Are you looking to reach a highly educated audience on franchising? For over 4 years, Franchise Interviews has been giving an up-close, behind-the-scenes look at franchising and entrepreneurship through our website, franchiseinterviews.com, where you can hear and read interviews as well as get inside tips from some of the most successful sources in franchising. Check out our weekly franchise radio show, where each week you get to hear a new interview with franchisers, franchisees, franchise authors, franchise experts, and attorneys, and our podcast, Great Quotes in Franchising. Get 3 months of free advertising when you sign up for our one-year package. For more information, go to franchiseinterviews.com or call us at 610-905-2919. That's 610-905-2919.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Franchise Interviews, where we're asking the franchisepreneur who owns one. I'm your host, Marty McDermott, with my co-host, Don Johnson. And if you've ever dreamed of owning your own business, then you've come to the right place. And as we were saying earlier, Don, we have a great show today. We're meeting with Dr. Scott Shane, author of Born Entrepreneurs, Born Leaders. And this is the first book to review the entire range of scientific literature on genetic effects on organizational behavior and explain in a practitioner-friendly manner how your DNA affects your workplace behavior. Hi, Dr. Shane. How are you today? Welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Shane. Dr. Shane, joining us is my co-host, Don Johnson, and I know, Don, you wanted to say good morning to Dr. Shane.
Dr. Shane, it's great to have you back on. We appreciate it. You're really keeping yourself busy lately, huh?
Yeah, I am. Well, that's my job.
Well, it's funny, Dr. Shane. I don't know if you remember, I know you do so many of these interviews. When we had you on the show, I guess it was about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, Don, we were talking about Illusions of Entrepreneurship, which was an incredible book. You kind of hinted that you were interested in this topic, you know, so it was great to see that you did come out with a book, you know, on the subject. Why did you write the book, Born Entrepreneurs, Born Leaders?
was actually something that I have been working on for several years now. So at the time that I spoke to you before, I was actually doing research on the topic. And
right.
I don't know, about 5 years ago, I got interested in whether there's truth to the kind of statement that people make all the time that, you know, certain people are just born entrepreneurs. And there's actually several different scientific methods that you can actually answer that question to see whether there is an innate component to being an entrepreneur and entrepreneurial performance and aspects of entrepreneurship like identifying opportunities. And I've started using those methods in doing my research. And then I thought, well, you know, there's a lot of interest amongst practitioners in this general topic. They're the ones who are often using these terms all the time. And in looking at it, I just realized that a broader book than just entrepreneurship would be necessary because there's issues related to leadership and job satisfaction
right.
and financial risk-taking and even the choice of occupations in general. So I thought, well, a broader book, but that looked at the genetic components to workplace behavior would be good.
Absolutely. And how is writing this book a different experience for you, you know, Dr. Shane, from like Illusions of Entrepreneurship or Fool's Gold? Is it a similar process or a little different? Because I know you don't have a background in genetics, which I guess doesn't make a difference, but...
Well, so some part of it was actually different and some part was similar. I mean, anytime you write a book that's based on kind of scholarly evidence, there's reading of that literature. The two big differences here were that in the other book, a very large portion of what I was writing was about my own research.
Right.
And here, a small portion of one chapter, the chapter on entrepreneurship, was about studies that I did with my colleagues, and
right.
the rest was just summarizing what other people had done. The other difference is that some of the research that needs to get reviewed is truly molecular genetics work, where people are trying to associate versions of specific genes with outcomes whether people are engaging in leadership or financial risk-taking or what have you. And that's just a little bit harder to work through because I had to move myself up the learning curve in understanding that research.
That's interesting. And what do you think people are so fascinated with this topic? We Don actually read one of your blogs on our show. I guess, Don, it was probably about like 6 months ago.
Right.
And you and I were both fascinated in the topic. But why are people so interested in this topic, Dr. Shane, you think?
Well, I think one part of the reason that people are interested is that people intuitively believe that some part of what we do in our jobs and everything else in life is innate. So scientists work hard at kind of trying to document this and keep people from overstating the case. But the intuition is that everything is not environmentally determined. There's some innate component to everything.
Right.
And so people are quite interested in that. I think that's one part of it. I think a second part of it that makes people interested is that it kind of suggests that down the road we're going to get better at training and incentives for people because much like people have developed personalized medicine where people have a version of a disease with certain genetic makeup, they're given certain drugs and not others. There's this idea down in the future that maybe that would happen for other activities as well, that, you know, this kind of person, the way we train them to be a leader is different than this other person. And I think intuitively a lot of people say, you know, I went to business school or I went to college and, you know, everybody's treated exactly the same way as if, you know, we just got this information and then we would all magically become entrepreneurs or leaders or what have you. And I think intuitively people are just skeptical that people can be treated the same way and get the same outcomes from it.
Yeah, and that's what I got. When I was reading the book, I remember in Chapter 7, Don, you were talking about Leona, who was a girl, I guess, studying leadership, and she was always fascinated in the topic and wasn't very, I guess, successful as a leader. And then her friend, I think it was Susan, people just followed her. So I guess that's like one example of that type of situation.
Right. And I mean, people sort of, this is intuitive to people, right? That everybody knows somebody that really, really wants to be a leader and just can't, no matter what.
Exactly.
It just seems that they're unsuccessful. And then there's other people who seem to be just naturally followed. And what is it about them? Is it really their life experiences that made them so different? And the part that makes that kind of difficult is that we start seeing some of these patterns, you know, in little kids. And, you know, you say, okay, well, you know, there's always some learning, but how much of, you know, a four-year-old following other four-year-olds and one four-year-old leading other four-year-olds, how much of that do we really think is the environment shaping them, right? You know, they've only had 4 years and they haven't had, you know, work environment experiences and these other things. Now, sure, how their family raised them and even experiences when you're two or three have an effect, but what people realize is, yeah, but probably there's something else.
Right.
And it's that something else that we want to know about.
Yeah, it is interesting, especially when you have kids, you see how it changes your life. I know you went through this, Don. You know, my son, Dr. Shane, he's 2 years old, and we could see he's kind of like a little follower, you know, in interacting with the other kids. He's not the leader of the group, you know, and you wonder, you know, is that just inborn, you know, as your book talks about, innate, you know. So it is a fascinating topic, that's for sure.
And it's also interesting timing, Dr. Shane, with what's going on with our country. So many people out of work and, you know, so many people being entrepreneurial and, you know, looking to start up their own business. We have a new generation of people being business owners, and I guess this will be good. People might want to learn a little bit more about themselves and if they are the right type to be creative or be entrepreneurial and aggressive and start up a business. But possibly talk a little bit more about genetics and what you mean by genetics for, you know, people listening to, you know, clearly understand it.
Right, and you know, I just, it's a good time to say that right now, because having said, you know, what you said before, I don't want people to be left with the idea that any of this is kind of deterministic, because it's
right.
not. What we're talking about is, you know, tendencies and probabilities. So, you know, just because there's some force that makes someone a little bit more likely to be a leader doesn't guarantee they're a leader and vice versa, but it's like capital, right? We know that people who have more net worth are more likely to start businesses because they can more easily self-finance, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't guarantee it. It just affects the odds, and it's a similar thing here as well. But what we mean when we talk about genetic factors is all the things that are innate to people that come essentially from their genetic makeup, and that could operate lots of different ways, right? We could have differences in how people are genetically coded and how that affects the neurotransmitters, the brain chemicals that operate to stimulate people. And a good example of this is dopamine receptors, and dopamine is the sort of the feel-good chemical in the brain.
Right.
And we know that some people's brains release more or less of the chemical, and you know, one of the questions is, okay, well, how might that affect behavior? And there's some evidence to suggest that, you know, some people who are less prone to releasing the dopamine or having the dopamine in their brains, they need more stimulation to do it. And so they might be more likely to seek more novelty in new situations and those kinds of experiences. And that's where we observe, actually, in some of the data that we've looked at, that, in fact, some people are innately more likely to seek new situations and seek novelty, and that those are people more likely to start businesses. Now, starting businesses isn't the only thing they're going to do. You know, some people might go into extreme sports or something else in response, but there's that biological effect. Then there's this other effect that essentially you get people who become more likely to have certain kinds of personalities or cognitive abilities, and that leads them down certain roads, right? If I am innately better at mathematics early on, that might take me down the road to being more likely to study math. And if that's the case, the odds of me becoming, you know, an actuary later in life are much higher than if I'm, you know, not heading down a mathematics road and I'm heading down a literature road. And, you know, then we know that there's interactions between the genetic makeup of people and the situations that they're in. So we've got some evidence on leadership that shows that people who are innately predisposed to be leaders, they have a genetic makeup. If those people have to overcome some kind of obstacle in their teenage years, some sort of bad thing that happened to their family, like the parent lost a job or they lost a parent or something like that, it's that interaction of being innately predisposed and the stimulus of having to overcome an obstacle that makes them more likely to adopt the leadership role. So we get all these different mechanisms all coming together to affect the tendency, but what they have all in common is some portion of the outcome is coming from innate differences.
So some people are more comfortable, when I was reading the book, Dr. Shane, in putting their money into like a high-risk business. I was thinking, you know, I was going to tell you before the show, Don, that this might apply to even franchising, because I guess, you know, the people that are investing into, and I know you wrote a book on this topic too as well, Dr. Shane, people investing in a franchise might invest in a franchise because they aren't, I guess their level of risk or risk-taking isn't as high, maybe because of something genetically within them. If they have, they're investing in a business that has a track record of success, I guess you can apply it to the world of franchising as well, couldn't you?
Well, right. So part of what we don't have is that we don't have a lot of evidence that would show the specific examples here.
Right.
And, you know, it's interesting because, I talk to, folks that do radio show on angel investing, and they say, well, how does this apply there? It's the same thing. It probably applies to everything,
right?
But we don't have the evidence that would say here's the example in the case of franchising. But what we do know is that there's an innate component to how much financial risk people are willing to take. And there's some very interesting studies where people, look at identical and fraternal twins, that's a good example because the identical twins share 100% of their genes and the fraternal twins share half, and that's
right.
How people can measure these genetic effects. And you see, okay, people go to some kind of money manager and they're asked to fill out a questionnaire about how they'd like their money allocated, and the evidence is there's a genetic component to how they fill out that questionnaire. And other people in Sweden, when they privatized the Social Security system, they actually linked that up to data about twins and found that actually whether people were choosing their Social Security to be in stocks or bonds was affected by their genetic makeup. And people have also even found versions of specific genes that are associated with that. So we know that risk-taking, which is probably kind of a basic aspect of human beings, throughout our entire history, is there. Well, that probably manifests itself not just in physical risks, but in taking financial risks. And if franchising is a type of financial risk-taking, then one would expect it to matter there as well. I don't have any evidence to show that, but, there's no reason to say, picking stocks and bonds, the innate component to risk-taking is there, but it wouldn't be to purchasing a business. That doesn't seem logical.
Wow, it's fascinating.
And Dr. Shane, do you feel that people fear discussing genetics or maybe finding out information about themselves that might be different than what they thought they were? Maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think there's two big issues. One part of it is that people say, well, I don't really want to know about these things because I might not be able to do anything about it. And, part of that is that that's the sort of initial first reaction. But one of the things that we realize is that there's probably actually down the road a bunch of things that will happen, that if people can do this kind of research and understand these things, they'll figure out what the link is between the stimulus that people need and their innate predispositions to get outcomes. And we all would like to have kind of an ability to have the things that we do make for desirable outcomes. So if we say, well, look, I really want to be a leader, but it
right.
seems like all these leadership training courses that I'm taking aren't doing anything. Well, why is that, right? And we don't have the answer today, but we might 10 years down the road be able to say, well, see, this kind of person, they're more likely to respond to this kind of training or information. So part of it is that people, their initial reaction is, I don't think I'm going to get anything out of knowing this. The second reaction is, this is informational really at this point, but it's not an action plan, right? We don't know enough information to say that. You know, I've written books on other topics where we can say, look, we really know a lot about how you would, say, design a franchise system so
right.
that a person can read the book and take it out today and do that. This isn't that kind of book. It's not going to tell you that. And then the third part is that people have a negative reaction that it'll just be used, the information will just be used badly. It'll be used for bad purposes. You know, my reaction to that kind of view always is, well, you know, just because you think something could be used for a bad outcome doesn't mean you want to ignore it, because most likely the only people who are going to pay attention to something are the people who are going to have ill motives if everybody else is afraid to look at it. And even if all you want to do is regulate something, you should understand the patterns. I mean, if you use the analogy of insider trading, we wouldn't want to say, oh, insider trading is bad, let's not look at it at all. And the only people who pay any attention to it are those who wanted to take advantage of it. We might want to say, oh, it's really bad, we need to understand how it happens and take action. So even if you think that these genetic effects are bad, you might want to know about them. So you could say, okay, well, we need to make sure they don't influence, we don't let people use them in the workplace.
Right. That's interesting. What would you say to people that want to be great leaders, Dr. Shane, or an entrepreneur, and let's say they haven't been successful? What do you say to those people? Like Leona was the one that came to mind. I referenced her earlier on. You mentioned her in Chapter 7 of the book. What advice would you give her if she's just been unsuccessful in leadership and she still wants to be a great leader? As you said, she went to all the training, she's read all the books, and she just is there anything she can do?
Right. So here's the difficult situation. The answer is there's always something you can do,
mm-hmm.
right? That all of this stuff is probabilistic, but part of it is what we want to do is give people a mental framework that doesn't say, I'm going to fix your problem, right? One of the things that actually business school professors do, I think that is unfortunate, is we kind of give an overinflated sense of how incentives and training and all this are going to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
You do it, it's going to work.
Right.
You want to be a leader, boom, we'll train you to be a leader. And what you realize is, no, it might not work for everyone because there are aspects of them that we can't tap and change, and we don't know how to do that yet. So if there is something about certain people's innate predispositions that we need to train them a little bit differently to be leaders, then they might experience a lot of kinds of training that we haven't figured out the right stimulus yet, and they're going to be unsuccessful. And the point is, you know, not to give up. I know that this isn't really the ideal answer, because what it's saying is kind of the sales job that people get of do this and your problems
right.
will go away. What this is saying is it's not so simple. And the problem is that that's not always the most appealing answer. It's not so simple. It's complicated. You need to keep working on it. We need to still try to figure it out. We don't have all the answers yet. Not 100% appealing, but I think it's the reality.
Wow. This is fascinating. And how, do you want to talk a little bit about management? I know in the book you spoke about a number of different topics, Dr. Shane. How about management style and how genes affect management style?
Right, so this is probably actually one of the areas that is probably the most interesting for people who are interested in franchising, because we know that franchising is a kind of business ownership that's different than other kinds of business ownership, that you will have to be part of a system, and so there are more rules about how you do what you're doing. And there's a lot of aspects of management behavior that have a genetic component, whether people, you know, are willing to break rules, whether they're very planning oriented, whether they're highly persistent, whether they're intuitive decision makers or not, whether they're risk taking. And you know, one of the things is that if people have a predisposition to be kind of a certain way, they are going to find it easier to be in situations that reinforce that, harder to be in situations that don't. Now, not all that comes from genetics, but in fact, what it's saying is that some people, innately, their style of managing might fit certain jobs and certain kinds of business startup situations better than others. It literally makes them feel more comfortable.
That's interesting. And do you think there's like tests that one should take, Dr. Shane, before, like, let's say, getting into a particular franchise opportunity? I know, Don, you've read some articles in the past about taking like personality tests, and some franchisors won't take you unless you pass this particular personality
right.
test. Did you have any thoughts on that, Dr. Shane, as far as like what kind of tests there are available and are they accurate?
So part of this is always tricky, because it's not that there's zero merit to these tests.
Mm-hmm.
There's some merit. The problem is that there's not a huge amount of predictive power of the test. But because we know that a big chunk of personality comes from innate forces, then, you know, what in essence people are saying is, look, I'm giving you this personality test because I'm looking for somebody who's a certain type to buy my franchise. And I know that some part of that is just how they were born. And I'm, in essence, making a selection. Now, the problem is that when you take all the factors into consideration, it's not strong enough to say, oh, well, the person with a certain personality would never be any good at being a franchisee. It's just about probabilities. Now, if say somebody with a certain personality is, you know, 5% less likely to be a good franchisee for a particular organization, and so somebody applies that test, does it mean that they couldn't do it? No, but it means that if you've got somebody who's picking 10,000 franchisees, 5% is enough of a people for them to say, you know what, it's worth me doing this selection because I can avoid a few people who wouldn't fit.
Yeah.
That's interesting, Dr. Shane. When I first got the book, what I always do, I look through the different chapters. I immediately went to Chapter 9, Born Entrepreneurs, How Your Genes Affect Your Tendency to Start Companies, because I've started a few companies. I've been in business 20 years. And for people listening, because this is not, you know, easy stuff to understand, but you did a great job in putting it in simple format so people could understand. But you say here, your genes influence the odds that you will become an entrepreneur. The statement is true whether entrepreneurship means being self-employed, owning and operating a business, founding a company, or participating in the business startup process. So I like how you clearly state that your genes, like you mentioned before, the tendencies and probabilities, I guess you have a greater chance if your genes have that type of makeup and your odds are better that you can be successful. I guess that's what you've really concluded with some of this work that you've done, right?
Right. Now part of this is that the way that we've come up with that evidence is by looking at identical and fraternal twins. And so basically, if there's a genetic component to something, identical twins should be more likely to both do it than the fraternal twins, and that's where you can find the effect. The catch to all of this is there could be, say, 500 different genes operating each with a tiny effect, and since people have all different combinations of those genes, it's not as if you're saying this person is going to be less likely to do so because they're missing, you know, X. It's more like, no, all together you add up all these effects and you see the patterns, right? Now, again, this is useful for people trying to understand what's going on. I'm not sure at this point that people can turn that into something that's necessarily, you know, completely proactive, because you might say, okay, well, I'm more likely to be an entrepreneur because of kind of how I was born, but I could still do it anyway. It will tell us that one set of people are more likely than others, but at the individual level, we don't have enough information yet to say, okay, well, the odds are too much not in my favor because of how I was born to do it. And we probably won't ever find anything that's so powerful as to say, you know, nobody should do it because the odds are so much against them. It's going to be a little more likely. It's the same way as saying, if you, to go back to the financing example, if you have more money, your odds of being able to start a business are greater. It doesn't mean that we should say to a person who has zero net worth, don't ever consider starting a business, right?
Right.
It just means, you know, you should probably be aware that, you know, your odds are a little lower being able to pull this off.
Dr. Singh, which, you know, this question I just thought up, would you rather have a great genetic makeup for, you know, starting up a business or being an entrepreneur, but maybe have average work ethic and passion for what you do, or maybe a little lower genetic makeup with great passion and work ethic?
Well, that's an almost impossible question to answer because the passion and work ethic is partially a result of your genetic makeup and partially a result of your environmental experience.
As well, okay.
Right.
So,
all of these things are having these effects. Where I think that this is going and where it would be useful in the future is if you say, okay, look, this person is innately kind of predisposed to be very passionate, but they're also innately predisposed to be really disorganized, and this other person is the opposite. What's the best kind of way to get them to be, each of them to be effective at starting businesses? Somewhere in the future, we'll probably be able to say, look, the passionate person who's disorganized, you need to do these kinds of things to help them become an entrepreneur. And the person who's not very passionate and highly organized, you need to do a different set of things. So I don't think it's going to be so much this set of people will be better or this set of people will be worse that, you know, 10, 20 years down the road we're going to be able to use this for. It's going to be saying, no, look, what's the best way to match? What's the best way to take advantage of who people are to make them able to have the work outcomes that they'd like to have?
Wow. And how far away you think are we from all this, Dr. Shane? I mean, 10 years, 20 years, I mean, are scientists actually researching this topic in addition right now?
Yeah, so people are doing it. I mean, one of the things that's happened over the past decade is that there's been a very big increase in the amount of work that uses the genetics to try to go outside of things like medicine and go into things like work-related behavior. Now, it's still tiny by the standards of the total number of people working on medical outcomes, but it's attracting interest, and people are starting to figure out that this matters. There's also these parallel paths that aren't about genetics, but other aspects of biology. There's a whole trend in what people call neuroeconomics and neuromarketing, where people are studying how people literally react to things. So if I give you an example of, you know, an advertisement, right? You know, you have an advertisement, you want people to buy stuff. Well, one of the things that these neuromarketing people have figured out is that different kinds of ads stimulate different parts of the brain, whether it's the kind of rational portion or the emotional portion, and you kind of want to, depending on what you're trying to do, you might want to trigger certain parts of the brain. And so what we realize is that there's a biological portion to these reactions that we need to understand, and that, you know, 20 years, 30 years down the road, I don't know how long it's going to be, we're going to probably see more of an understanding that there is a link between people's biology and things that happen in the work world.
And what's next for you, Dr. Shane? Are you going to continue studying this topic? I mean, you can see your passion for it.
Yeah, so I think that probably for for a long time, this will be the focus of the kind of research that I'm doing. Part of it is that now that we're moving into doing work with molecular geneticists, we're literally trying to find, are there specific genes associated with things like recognizing business opportunities? It's a step-by-step process of small steps that take a long time. So, I would say that probably for the at least the next decade, that's what it's going to be the focus of my attention.
That's terrific. And how?
Franchise Interviews. For over 4 years, Franchise Interviews has been giving an up-close, behind-the-scenes look at franchising and entrepreneurship through our website, franchiseinterviews.com, where you can hear and read interviews as well as get inside tips from some of the most successful sources in franchising. Check out our weekly franchise radio show, where each week you get to hear a new interview with franchisers, franchisees, franchise authors, franchise experts, and attorneys. And don't forget to listen to our podcast, Great Quotes in Franchising. For more information, go to franchiseinterviews.com or call us at 610-905-2919. That's 610-905-2919.
Need a business loan? Talk to Diamond Financial Services, the experts in franchise financing nationwide. Whether you're looking to start a franchise, acquire an existing franchise, or expand your territory through opening new locations, Diamond Financial stands by your side start to finish. From pre-qualification to packaging and presenting your application to securing a financial commitment and through the loan closing process, Diamond Financial is there. While you're waiting, thousands of others are making their financial dreams come true. Don't wait any longer. Pre-qualify now by completing a confidential, no-obligation financial analysis. Let's face it, traditional banks just aren't in the business of financing small business. At Diamond Financial, we specialize in securing franchise loans from $100,000 to $3 million and equipment leasing up to $150,000. Let us help you get started. Go to www.franchisefunding.net or call 877-508-2274. That's franchisefunding.net, 877-508-2274. 508-2274.
Got a business problem, the last thing at night. Then other things maybe we'll talk about next week is treat your computer systems like a factory production line and pretend you have an accounting department. So she brings up some interesting points on those.
Okay, good. Yeah. Hey, Dr. Scott, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
How you doing, Dr. Scott?
Good. How about yourself?
Good, good. Dr. Shane, joining us is my co-host Don Johnson, and Don is the president of Diamond Financial Services. And I know you wanted to say hi, Don, to Dr. Shane.
Hi, Dr. Shane. We thank you for coming on the show. Martin and I have been looking forward to this a few weeks with the book you wrote, really some new information for us. So, we look forward to speaking to you. Thanks for coming on.
Great, thanks.
Dr. Shane, we always like to start off by asking our guests, where are you calling from this morning?
Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay, great. How's the weather there today?
Actually, it's quite beautiful today.
Good, good. Well, September's like that, I know, in Ohio. We've actually had a lot of franchises from the Ohio area, haven't we, Don?
Yeah,
franchisees,
yeah.
Doing the show over the last 2 years. Yeah, absolutely.
Dr.
Shane, how did you get involved or interested in entrepreneurship?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I'm the child, actually, of two entrepreneurs. And
oh, interesting.
You probably don't know this, but I actually have an area of research where I look at genetic factors that lead people to become entrepreneurs. There's actually some evidence that our genes affect that, so it's quite possible that's why I got interested.
That's interesting. This is one of the questions or debates we had. We did a blog a long time back, Dr. Shane, as far as, can entrepreneurship be taught or are entrepreneurs born, So it's interesting that you actually mentioned that.
That's the first I've heard of it, too, as far as, could be in your genes. I guess maybe my dad will be happy about that. he's owned some businesses and has done pretty well. He was a pilot, but he's done some other things. I'll have to talk to my dad about that.
Right.
Dr. Shane, why did you write the book, The Illusions of Entrepreneurship?
Well, I actually have been researching entrepreneurship for close to 20 years now, and what had happened was I started seeing things that I thought I knew to be true, and when I'd investigate them, I realized that I was wrong. And I thought, well, you know, if I have this list of things that I thought were correct, and it turns out when I looked at the data carefully that I was wrong, probably a lot of other people had the same illusions that I did, and, you know, I picked up enough of these to think it was worthy of a book.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, that's interesting. If you know, and I read how you just coming across a lot of people didn't have the correct information, the facts as they're starting a business, which obviously
right.
could be crucial. I mean, you got to be, I mean, you have to be on your game. I mean, you have to make sure that business plan is solid. I mean, the odds are against you to begin with starting out. So if you have you know, wrong information, I guess you go down the wrong path pretty quickly. So it's interesting how you keyed in on that and you know, saw that as an opportunity.
And then the other thing is that entrepreneurs actually tend to be over-optimistic. We have some evidence
right.
that that's true. And so what happens is if you've got wrong information out there combined with a tendency to be over-optimistic, you can really get a lot of people into trouble. And, you know, people are investing real money that they could lose in this. And you want them to actually know the right odds. There's nothing wrong with taking a risk if you know the right odds.
Right.
But what you don't want to do is take the risk thinking, you know, you're going to be really successful when the odds are really against you.
That's true, yeah. I mean, a lot more people today, Dr. Chain, are using their retirement funds, you know, to get into these things, you know. So the book really does make you, I think, you know, think twice about going into your own business, that's for sure.
We talked about that in you know, segment one, Marty, about
right.
People going into business. And make sure you have that cash reserve. Make sure you have plenty of working capital. I mean, that's a whole other side conversation, but one important step of the whole process of starting up a business. Dr. Chain, who should read the book?
Well, I think it's useful for a lot of different audiences. First, I think it's useful for anybody who's starting a business or thinking of starting a business because, you know, they probably want to get the facts right and not have a bunch of illusions about things like where they're going to finance their business. You don't want a bunch of people thinking, oh, they're going to get venture capital money when they're really not.
Right.
So entrepreneurs are one set. Another side is the investors, the people who are putting money in, because you don't want people thinking that their chances are really high of making a huge amount of money off of the typical entrepreneur, and then, of course, thinking that the entrepreneur they backed is somehow the real lemon out there because they didn't do as well as some expectation. And then I think policymakers are another important audience because we've got a lot of governments, the local government, state government, federal government, all trying to encourage economic growth through entrepreneurship.
Right.
And the key is they've got to understand what kind of entrepreneurship is generating jobs and generating wealth. Otherwise, they're just going to waste our tax dollars.
Absolutely. For our audience, Dr. Chain, what questions does the Illusions of Entrepreneurship address? Again, Don and I both read the book, but...
Well, so one question is, what does it take to make a new business successful? And one of the things that the book points out is that a lot of the things that we believe, that it's a lot about us as people, are inaccurate. That things like the kind of business opportunity you have and the industry that you're in account for a lot of performance. And I think what happens to a lot of people is we have this belief as human beings that we want to over-ascribe our performance to things that are about ourselves and not about things we can't really control. We can't change our industry very well. We can't change our business opportunities very well. So we like to think that it's us that matters. And it turns
right.
out that, sure, individuals matter, but the business opportunity matters to a great extent. And being able to pick that, and what the book tries to do is help people see, well, what is it about a good opportunity? What is it about an industry that makes it good for startups? The other thing is that people make a lot of mistakes that could easily be corrected. They go after the wrong kind of financing. They don't do a business plan well. They don't form a good team. They don't set up the right legal structure. And one of the things that the book tries to point out are kind of the easy-to-fix mistakes, the things that are under
right.
your control so that you can fix the odds. I mean, you can't decide whether, you know, your particular product is suddenly going to become the hottest thing ever, but you can avoid making a, you know, mistake about getting, you know, your cash flow wrong because you don't have a financial structure in place to manage cash flow. And then I think that the other thing is that I think is very useful is for people to get a realistic understanding of where money comes from for financing businesses, because I think people labor under a lot of illusions about where that capital comes from. And one of the goals of the book is to say, hey, look, this is how people really get money, and this is what they're going to have to do. And you're probably not going to get venture capital. You're probably not going to get business angel money from a lot of businesses. What you're probably going to do is either invest your own money or you're going to personally guarantee loans from a bank.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that's my business, as you might have heard Dr. Shane. We, you know, our company's talking to many people every day across the country, and there is a lot of misconception. Sometimes people think, they can, get financing, for example, as long as they just have good credit, but there's a lot of other things that lenders look for, with getting financing. So we're always in that, consulting and giving advice mode to people. And helping people with the whole financing part. So what you were just addressing is, really people have to do more due diligence, and for people to do their research on an industry and so forth. I guess you recommend that people should align themselves with consultants and specialists to help them in this process of considering starting up a business, or if they decide, to make sure they go about it the right way.
Well, they need to get information somehow. Now, you can get information by getting help from consultants. You could get information by kind of doing research. You could get information by talking to people in an industry. I think one of the misconceptions that people labor under is that entrepreneurship is easy. You can just, if you get an idea, whatever idea you get, you should just go run with it. You should go do it. There's this emphasis on being active and going and doing, as opposed to thinking about whether an idea is any good. And one of the things that I think is really important that people always keep in their mind is that once you pick an idea to pursue, you've basically cut yourself off from pursuing a better idea that comes along later, because you've committed to one idea. And so what you probably want to do is go evaluate an idea and say, is this one really worth doing? Because if I look at it and I say, oh, it's not worthwhile, I still have the option to do a better idea when it comes along. But if I go pursue something that isn't very good, I'm probably going to end up locked into kind of either trying to make a go of it and possibly failing.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. Were you surprised, Dr. Shane, by some of the findings during the research phase of writing the book?
Absolutely. I was particularly surprised about things like how people really finance businesses. I was surprised at how frequently debt is used, because we have this view somehow that people get equity a lot, and they think it's that a small number of businesses get equity and they get written about a lot, but getting outside equity is pretty rare. So the financing stuff surprised me. The effect of how important industry is and what industry you're in, that surprised me a lot too. I thought it was important, but I didn't think it was as important. I think that what also surprised me a lot was how many things matter that are easy to fix, and yet people still make those mistakes because they just don't have the right information. As an economist, you sort of think that the system works pretty well, and that there's not going to be a lot of things you could do to improve just because you didn't know. We tend
right.
to think people generally know what they're doing, and then it's things beyond their control that affect their performance.
That's interesting. I was amazed, Dr. Shane, at the self-employment rates. Everyone's always talking about the rise of entrepreneurship here in America, and looking at the other countries, compared to the United States. I think Turkey might have been one of them, and Mexico was another. Were you surprised there? Again, I see a lot of textbooks, you're a professor, talking about the rise of entrepreneurship here in the U.S.
There were two parts of that were very surprising to me. So it turns out that the U.S. isn't very entrepreneurial by a number of measures, self-employment, number of businesses that get created every
right.
year, per capita, that kind of thing, and that it used to be much more so, that we're on a declining trend, and also the fact that places where we think of that have a lot of high-growth entrepreneurial activity within the U.S., places like Silicon Valley,
mm-hmm.
they actually aren't very high on the total amount of entrepreneurial activity, and places that have kind of many fewer high-growth startups actually tend to have a higher proportion of people running their own businesses. And it's interesting, but if you kind of explore it a little bit, you realize that it makes a lot of sense, that a lot of times what people are doing is they're starting businesses because they don't have a better option, and that the businesses they're starting aren't particularly successful, and that as countries get better and you've got a lot of economic growth, people opt in to go into work for somebody else because things are better. And you can think of this as Walmart is a lot more competitive than a lot of the small independent businesses that it's essentially replaced. And Walmart doing that and replacing a grocer and replacing a florist and replacing the bike store and replacing all those things, that's actually lowering the rate of entrepreneurship over time. The other thing that happens is you think about a company like Google, and you think about how they're providing all these high salaries and all these good perks to people, and a lot of people, when those are their job options, will say, well, maybe I shouldn't start a business if, you know, I can get free sushi for lunch at Google.
Right. Interesting.
Are there temporary ups and downs in what you're speaking about, Dr. Shane, like in a down economy or heavy layoffs? I mean, might be a spike in people starting up businesses. I guess it could go up and down, but the overall theme, and I was surprised, you just think with the increasing population, there's going to be more people starting businesses, more entrepreneurs, but you just found really the opposite.
Oh. Well, let me be clear. No, this was on a per capita basis that we see the decline. So the population, in an absolute sense, we have more entrepreneurs, but as a percentage of the population, it's shrinking. And yes, there are ups and downs. I mean, this is the overall trend. That one of the things that's interesting is that down economies tend to cause a spike in the increase in the amount of entrepreneurship. And one of the reasons why is that when people are unemployed, their odds of starting a business go up a lot. And so when you get more people being unemployed, you see a spike in the aggregate statistics.
Interesting,
yeah.
And I just wanted to ask real quick, backtrack a little bit. What is your definition of an entrepreneur?
A person who starts their own business.
So really as simple as that?
As simple as that.
This is all very interesting, and Marty and I, being in the franchise industry, I just want to ask you, what are your thoughts on the growth of franchising over the last decade, Dr. Shane?
Well, what I think is interesting, you probably know, I've written on the franchise industry,
yeah.
Particularly from the point of view of franchisors, and what's interesting is that there seems to have been a plateauing of kind of the franchise activity. And it hasn't been spreading as much as it had, say, over the decade before that. And it seems a little bit like franchising is big. It's a big chunk of the economy, but it's hard to break into a lot of new industries successfully, industries where franchising historically didn't work. You get a few of them where that tends to happen, but for the most part, franchising seems to work in certain sectors of the economy well, other sectors of the economy not that well, and we aren't getting the huge growth in that activity that we got 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Well, Marty, last week, remember, we talked about how doctor's offices, chiropractors and specialists are starting to franchise their concept. I thought that was pretty interesting. So maybe, Dr. Shane, that's an example. The jury's still out if franchising could be successful for, say, podiatrists or chiropractors or, the specific niches, dentists in franchising. It's kind of an interesting comparison, right?
Right, and, in the book, that I did From Ice Cream to the Internet on franchising, one of the things that's pretty clear is that these medical areas, where we've seen this before, we had hemorrhoid clinics as one area.
Good example.
We've had dentists actually for quite a while without kind of a huge growth in that activity. One thing that's difficult about these things is that it's hard to sell them to a lot of people because you can't really sell the franchise to somebody where there's no dentist involved, right? I mean, you've got to have some professional that's providing that service.
Right.
And in fact, one of the areas that could possibly see some of this franchising growth are these quick care clinics, where people have toyed with the model of, well, should they franchise that or should they own them directly? And the big question is, well, is the market big enough, right? If I'm going to have an ice cream franchise, pretty much anybody who wants to run their own business, I could sell that to. If I'm going to have a quick care clinic and I'm going to need, you know, to have doctors or nurse practitioners involved, can I sell it to a third party who's going to hire those people, or do I need to sell it to them? And if I'm selling it to them, is the market big enough?
You know, industries like senior care and just services in general just had a lot of big growth in franchising.
I
guess franchising kind of rode the tide of the growing population, not the the older population. It's been pretty interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a good. The senior care though is a good example of something where it works pretty well, because you don't need a tremendous amount of technical expertise to provide that service. That's different than a dentist, right? I mean, you need a lot of technical knowledge to provide that service.
Right. Good point. What advice would you give to an aspiring entrepreneur looking to buy a franchise or start their own business? You've touched on a few things, but I'm sure you have a few more, Dr. Chain.
Well, so one thing that I think is important that people consider that's actually often not thought about enough and directly relates to franchising is thinking about the decision about buying versus starting from scratch. One of the things that we see is that businesses, when you buy a business from somebody else, those businesses tend to perform better than when people start businesses from scratch. And the question is, can people buy them at the right price so that the numbers work just as well as starting from scratch?
Now is that buying an existing business or buying a startup franchise concept?
Buying an existing business.
Okay.
Right? And so one of the things then about that is, one of the advantages is if you got a business and somebody else has run that business, there's some evidence that the business works. And the same thing is true when you look at a franchise, right? Which is that if you're really talking about buying a franchise where there's some evidence that that business is ongoing and been successful for a number of years, you're going to get a real advantage. Now, again, it's always a question of making the numbers work, because it's more expensive than starting a business from scratch. It could be a better business, but the numbers work worse for you because you didn't get it at a good enough price to make it work. So the first point that I'd make is that it's really important for people to actually not just immediately fall into, I'm starting a business, I'm starting from scratch, I'm starting with my idea, and I'm going to go from there, buying either a franchise or an existing business from an independent, is certainly worth considering. And the second thing is that it makes a huge difference when you're buying a franchise, whether the franchisor is new or the franchisor is well established, because a lot of the value in the franchise is that system is there, it's the system works, the system's there to support you. And one of the problems with a new franchise is that you can certainly have some that will turn out great, but a lot of them just fail. And then if that happens, that's not the greatest arrangement for the franchisee.
That's interesting. One of the things we were talking about earlier, Dr. Chain, in segment one is the importance of having a niche in the market. And I recall in the book you mentioned that I think it was 30% of the people starting up a business didn't believe they had a competitive edge. Were you surprised about that? I mean, I was.
Yes, I was. I was actually very surprised at the idea that people would be willing to start a business for which they didn't believe they had a competitive advantage, because it makes you wonder what their logic was for thinking that business would be sustained and would keep going. Another thing that's surprising that's probably related to that is a lot of people start businesses and it takes them a long time to get that business going. And I think what may be happening is that people start without a competitive advantage, and a year later they realize that, it's not enough. They haven't gotten that business up and running, and they probably won't, because they realized later they didn't have a competitive advantage.
Exactly. Interesting. So what are some other industries, Dr. Chain, that are popular for startups? Where should people be looking?
Well, this actually goes to a really important question, which is that when you ask the question, what's popular, and you don't want to couple that with where should people be looking, because in fact, it's the most popular industries that tend to be the worst. And
interesting,
One of the statistics I've got in the book, which is very, really frightening, is that the rate at which people start businesses in industry, right, how popular that industry is correlated 0.77, a really high correlation with the failure rate in that industry. People systematically pick the industries where their odds are most against them, and it's because they're easy to enter. So, you know, when you say what's popular, I would say, you know, there's a bunch of things that are popular. It's personal services, it's retail, it's construction, but that's not good. And the difficult part is that it turns out that most businesses are not great businesses to start, and that if you want to start a good business, it's going to be harder to find, and there's going to be a lot more obstacles that are going to suggest that maybe you don't want to pursue that, and make it a higher hurdle for you to overcome to say, oh yeah, it's worth trying.
That's interesting.
And I guess a popular industry, something like food, which is what, Marty, maybe 40-50% of the whole franchising industry. It's something easy to go into.
Right.
You know, I guess that's a good example, Dr. Shane, of someone choosing food because it's there's so many food franchises, but maybe there's a higher chance of failure with certain concepts, maybe.
Right, and so and food is a good example of something. Any kind of food in retail are in industries with very high failure rates, and this is where, you know, people might really seriously benefit from thinking about buying a franchise from an established system, because your odds are so much against you in starting a business from scratch in those industries. Now, there may be other industries where, you know, franchising offers much less of an advantage and startups do, you know, particularly well. Kind of the opposite to that might be computer-related businesses, where startups actually tend to do incredibly well. Actually, a quarter of the past 25 years, a quarter of all the Inc. 500 companies are computer-related. And there's very little kind of value-added typically provided by franchisors there. And so that the balance is probably going to be different in different industries. But, you know, food is the poster child for industries where it's hard to do well as an entrepreneur.
And the computer and related services to that industry is interesting because most people can probably just dip into that type of franchise fresh with no experience at all, which is what franchising is all about. But, you know, sometimes it's nice to have a business ownership experience. But so I thought that was an interesting industry you brought up. Why do people start businesses in general?
Well, here's an interesting fact. So the number one reason why people start businesses is because they want independence. They don't want to have a boss. They want to be in charge. And what's problematic is that that tends not to be something that motivates people to perform very well financially. It's sort of, you know, if my idiot boss can do this, I can do it too. So
right.
I'm just going to go and do it because I don't like working for that idiot. And the problem is that generally is not something that makes people very successful, but it's the dominant reason why people do it.
Right. And how many jobs do new businesses create? I guess you talked about that in your book, of course.
Right. So this is something that's kind of, on average, not very many. So if we look at businesses that are under 2 years of age in the United States, they account for 1% of the jobs in this country, which is minuscule. And one of the things that gets lost in this discussion always about job creation and entrepreneurship is that small business does not mean new business, right? A small business could be quite old. You can have a 100-year-old small business. A small business is a function of the business's size. And because so few new businesses are successful, it takes a while, and they don't start with very many jobs. It takes a while for you to get any of them generating many jobs, and when they do, it's a small percentage of them that accounted for most of that job growth.
So you're saying 1% of all the new businesses starting nationwide, whether it's a franchise, non-franchise, just all you know, businesses, and you're saying just 1% of the total jobs is just created from that. I thought that was higher as well.
1% of all employment in the private sector in this country are businesses that are 2 years old or younger.
That's amazing,
right?
Isn't it? It's incredible.
To get to get to a point where the majority of jobs are in businesses that are businesses that are young, you have to define young as 10 years old or younger. And the thing about 10 years old, right, is, I mean, if you just use the analogy of children, you realize that 10 is not a newborn, right? 10 is not new. 10 is actually fairly old, and there's been a lot of businesses that have failed by the time you get out there. In fact, close to three-quarters of all the startups are gone by the time a business reaches its 10th anniversary.
Wow, it's all interesting information, statistics. We're speaking with Dr. Scott Shane, wrote the book, The Illusions of Entrepreneurship, and earlier you talked about that you were surprised when you're doing your research on how people are financing their startup business. Maybe let's talk about that in a little more detail. How do entrepreneurs finance their startups?
Well, the main way that people finance the startups that most entrepreneurs don't take enough into consideration is with their savings, right? That they don't get money from anywhere else. That is the vast majority of people, that's how it's financed. And so the idea that you're going to raise capital is something that only matters for a minority of entrepreneurs. The second fact that's important is that businesses that are 4 years old or younger, the majority of the money they get is debt, not equity. And so we have this illusion somehow that you can't borrow money for young businesses. In certain industries, in certain sectors, that's very difficult to do, but in general, it's not that hard to do. And in fact, the number one source for capital for businesses that are young are actually banks. And that's something that people forget. They say, oh, yeah, I'm going to go to friends and family, I'm going to go to business angels, I'm going to go to venture capitalists, all those things. I'm going to go get a corporate strategic partner, I'm going to get all those things. You bundle all those things up together, and they still finance fewer businesses than young businesses than banks do. But the catch, the piece that's important, is that most new businesses do not get financing on the merits of the business itself. Most of that borrowing is somehow personally guaranteed by the entrepreneurs. So one of the things that I think most people are not taking enough into consideration is that the normal financing pattern for a new business is, I use my own money, I transition into somebody else's money that I have personally guaranteed, and then if my business is successful, I can transition from that to borrowing on the merits of the business itself. But that's much further downstream, and
right,
my personal credit and my money are very important in my ability to finance my own business.
Well, I'm not surprised what you're saying, because as time goes on, you're reading more about people having more debt and less savings, so it is tougher for someone to use their savings to start up, and that's all I do our small business loans. So I'm glad to hear your research is kind of backing up my industry, and that more people need to go to a bank to get financing, because our numbers are increasing as well. I'm just surprised maybe there's not a few more people who are aligning themselves with those angel investors or private investors partners. I tend to think there's more of that going on, but you're showing it's actually there's not that much of that activity, Dr. Shane, right?
Right, and part of this is that very few businesses actually stand a chance of generating the kind of growth that would provide sufficient returns to an equity investor. It's just actually pretty rare. So, in fact, the thing that I think is important to keep in mind is what the typical business looks like. Half of all businesses that get started project sales of $100,000 in 5 years. Now, if you're starting with half of businesses like that, you're talking about you're getting down to a very small number of businesses that are planning to generate the kind of growth it's going to take to interest investors. And so you certainly have them, but they're a small portion of the total. And banks and other kinds of sources of debt financing can finance operations in a way that makes sense, where people could service debt, but the business would not generate a high return on the equity that was invested in it.
And I definitely confirm with you that that a lot of the banks we work with do look more at the individual, the strength of the individual, rather than, say, for example, the franchise business they're starting, which is important. But most loans get approved based on, you know, the individual and their credit and their net worth and, you know, liquidity and past experience and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's interesting. Other characteristics, Dr. Shane, of successful entrepreneurs? You know, a lot of times, you know, Don and I have read articles, you know, talking about the importance of persistence and, you know, motivation and all that other stuff. Have you come across anything like that in your research?
So here's the thing that we've tended to find in doing the research is that characteristics of people seem to explain more about their decision to be an entrepreneur than they do about performance as an entrepreneur. And so people, if they are kind of really want independence, they tend to start businesses, but that desire for independence doesn't really translate into a much of a performance effect. And it turns out that there's very few of the personality characteristics that people describe as being so important for the performance of entrepreneurs really pan out. You know, persistence is a good example. People say persistence, that's an important characteristic. It's important in the sense that it's necessary, but it's not sufficient. There's lots
right.
of, right, if you're not persistent, you're not going to do very well. But being persistent is only can they keep you in the game, and there's lots of persistent people who fail. You know, I like to use the example that in the year that Bill Gates started Microsoft, there were a whole bunch of people probably just as persistent as he was who started businesses, and none of them created a business like Microsoft, right? And in fact, a very large number of those persistent people failed. So your persistence isn't going to account for the performance. We like to think that, you know, if we have the right stuff, we're going to do well. The problem is that really having a good business opportunity, managing it well in an attractive industry actually tends to work a little bit better.
That's fascinating.
So it's the quality of the service or brand.
An industry, right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that people actually greatly underestimate, right, is thinking about the basic question of why the world needs this business,
right?
You know, most businesses that people start, one of the reasons that they fail is because they're unnecessary. The world doesn't need yet another of that business, right? If that business is not... If the business doesn't solve a problem that was unsolved before or doesn't solve it in a way better than existing businesses solve it, there's no reason to have that new business. And most people don't go into entrepreneurship thinking about that. They actually think, you know, differently. They say, I'm going to start a business. I'm going to have the same product, and I'm going to sell it to similar customers as my previous employer. And the problem with that is, there's really no advantage over that previous employer, so the previous employer's business was successful, but the new one that starts to compete doesn't do as well.
Interesting. What's next for you, Dr. Shane, after this book? I know you're doing a lot of interviews and things like that, but what's in your future? More books?
Well,
or?
I actually have recently finished up another book that's going to be coming out this winter on angel investing that looks at you know, what's really true and not true about angel investing and how people can become successful angel investors and how people can better get money from angels. That book's called Fool's Gold.
That's an interesting topic.
Great title, and that's an area where, you know, a lot of people really need to be educated in that. I know personally I'm in the money business, but I don't really know much about that at all.
Right. That's interesting. What's the best way for someone to buy the book, Dr. Shane, Illusions of Entrepreneurship, or any of the other, I think it's 11 other books that you've written up to this point?
Yeah, so I generally suggest that people just go on Amazon.com and either look up my name or the title, because Amazon discounts all of those books, and you might as well save a little money if you're going to get it.
That's fantastic. Right. We're going to put some links up on our websites, too, as well, right, Don, on Franchise Interviews and also on Blog Talk. I know there's a big picture of Illusions of Entrepreneurship on the homepage of Blog Talk
Definitely.
Radio this morning.
Right.
So, yeah, but I want to thank you, Dr. Shane. The book was, again, definitely an eye-opener for myself and Don, and I guess the thousands of other people that have read the book. You know, it's just it really made a very big impact on our lives. So thank you for writing it.
Yeah, great work, Dr. Shane. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks, Dr. Take Shane. Care. Have a great
bye-bye.
Day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Great book, huh, Don?
Yeah, I think it was. I thought it was great having him on the show to talk about, you know, some of these myths, and I mean, he did, you know, research.
He did a ton of research.
I'm going to talk to my dad. I mean, you know, it's in my genes that I have to be successful here.
There you go. But next week we have who is it? We have Brian Spindell.